You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. We live in a country that loves to think of itself as the land of opportunity, a place where it just takes smarts and hard work to get ahead, a place that draws people from all over the world, and a place that grows richer from their presence, a place originally described by an ambitious Irish Catholic politician as a nation of immigrants. Of course, that's a myth. It's a story America tells itself about who we are and what we do. And it's a myth that our next guest set out to demolish through one history after another of what it means to bring newcomers into a society built on settler colonialism. We're joined by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, radical historian, author of many books. Her latest is Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Exclusion. Roxanne, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Brian.
I know that, like, running through your head, there are any number of projects that you could commit a book's worth of work to at any point in time. Why did you tackle this one? Why the Nation of Immigrants myth?
Well, you know, it's always annoyed me when every time I hear the phrase, which is, you know, quite often if you look at the media and just people in conversation. And so in 2005, I wrote what I call a rant, monthly review that published it, called it an essay, but it was a rant. And it was a rant against, it says, stop calling it a nation of immigrants. And so I just ranted about settler colonialism, how to racist settlers, and that Mexicans, you know, are not really immigrants, you know, they're agricultural workers and migrants in any way. It used to be their territory, you know, before the United States took it. And so I went on and on. And it kind of, you know, was one of those things that kind of went viral, you know, it just sort of popped up everywhere. It was very short, and it spread to other blogs and things. And then I didn't, you know, it didn't even cross my mind to write a book about it. I just had my rant, and that was it. And then in 2015, this Alexander Hamilton, the musical, Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical became a blockbuster. And that really, really annoyed me, because it's basically a nation of immigrants musical, and making Alexander Hamilton an immigrant. So completely erasing settler colonialism. Alexander Hamilton was a settler. He was not an immigrant from anywhere. He was in the British Empire. He moved from one British colony to another to go to university. Again, though, it did not really occur to me to write a book. I, you know, just raving about things instead of thinking of, well, maybe I should write something about that. Until my editor at Beacon, my wonderful editor, who edited my Indigenous People's History of the United States, out of the blue one day said, do you think you could make a small book out of this? And it's like a light going on in my brain, you know. I said, huh, I could do that. Yeah, why haven't I done that? So long story short, I got the contract, and that was about 3 or 4 years ago. And I was traveling a lot, lecturing, always very busy and writing short things. I did publish another book, you know, I was busy publishing. I published a Loaded, a Disarming History of the Second Amendment with City Lights. So I was on book tour, and then I was doing lectures, and I just, you know, kept putting off. I had made my outline. I had sort of outlined the book and had the chapter summaries, and I was all ready to go, but I didn't get to it. until the pandemic. And of course, I had no excuse. And that's what I did last year, finished the book in December. But unbeknownst to me, when I started researching for that book, I found the origin story, which I didn't know. All that time, I didn't know. You referred to the politician who created the term. I absolutely did not know that John F. Kennedy had published a book in 1958 called A Nation of Immigrants, and that is the first time that phrase was ever used. So that then is the first chapter of this book, is that origin of the term and his possible motives, being son of immigrants and a Catholic, neither of which had ever thought of running for president before. It was just a no-no. It had to be a WASP, old settler heritage, definitely not sons of immigrants to be a presidential candidate. So he had to buck that. And I think the book is really designed to be a propaganda, basically preparing. He wrote it when he was a senator in 1958, but he was already preparing to run for president. And I think he wrote that to legitimize himself. So that, you know, that was is a real eye-opener, finding the origin. I kind of kicked myself for not figuring, you know, asking that question before. Well, what's the origin of this? it is, you know, it is very interesting. What I wouldn't have thought in the past would frame this whole story would be evidence of the mythology that I could present as a context to writing about this pretty sordid history of the book. But I do start with settler colonialism, a very long chapter explaining exactly what it is and giving an example of Appalachia, you know, as a self-indigenizing, how settlers, old settlers, come to think of themselves as being first settlers. Appalachians were first settlers. And it's a kind of considered, you know, kind of a mystical, romantic place, because these are the original, you know, kind of settlers. So they self-indigenize. They don't pretend to be native people, but they have their kind of mythology that the native people died off and kind of gave them, you know, gave them indigeneity. And that's played out in the Last of the Mohicans, of course, the Fenimore Cooper's 1830s, five volumes, I think, on the process of settlers becoming the indigenous peoples. So that's settler colonialism. And then I go into, you know, slavery and why, of course, descendants of African enslaved Africans certainly were not immigrants by any means. They certainly weren't settlers. So they there's a term that a Trinidadian poet came up with, arrivance, for people who don't fit into the settler or immigrant description. So I use that, I borrowed that term. Then I go into the, you know, the Irish, you know, the Irish refugees, the 1840s, 2 million starving Irish refugees, and a whole history of their colonization and then their Americanization. I posted on Facebook a question. You know, I said, I'm now working on this chapter on the Irish refugees. I said, does anyone have any suggestions? I quit counting at 4,000 or 5,000. You know, I think people are still posting on that. I just haven't gone back to it. It's just overwhelming. There were some real gems, you know, especially from Irish scholars, mostly who contacted me. And a couple of them, I really use a lot of their ideas and material. But I realized in, you know, reading these responses, there was really a mythology around Irishness that wasn't matching up with with the facts of. But one person posted on there, I'm sure it is a woman's name. I didn't know her. You know, my question was, Noel Ignatius' question, how did the Irish become white? And she posted, when they became the police. So I took that cue and went with it. And it's a pretty sad story of how the Irish became the police and still are.
I'd love to get into that story in a few minutes, but first maybe return to the through line from John F. Kennedy, the first person to coin the phrase, we're a nation of immigrants, and follow the through line to Lin-Manuel Miranda, who creates this smash Broadway hit, imagining Alexander Hamilton as principally being an immigrant success story, in a way that lets him cast all of the founding fathers as people of color. I guess the question I want to get at is, like, what's the utility of the myth? What does the myth do for this society in such a way that it outlives kind of the narrow purpose of making John F. Kennedy palatable to the American electorate?
I think it's one of the most useful and pernicious myths. I mean, there are so many, it's hard to choose, but it sort of is the umbrella one of, you know, people, technically, the term, you know, someone crossing an ocean or crossing a border from one country to another, the word in English for that is immigrant. You know, people used to use the term for people who went from back east to the California Gold Rush. They were immigrants. And the Dust Bowl Okies, you know, where I come from in Oklahoma, they often call themselves in California immigrants. So the term can be tossed around in that way, you know, as we do English terms. It's not a, you know, like a medical technical term or something. And then there's migration, you know, like agricultural workers and all. But the United States has built this, and this is only since the Nation of Immigrants, once it got incorporated into the liberal multicultural, curriculum, you might say, and language in the 1960s, and, you know, with the civil rights movement and red power and brown power and women's. This multiculturalism that developed, it carried with them this Nation of Immigrants myth. So it really came from a liberal position. This is at the same time the right wing was going for originalism, you know, the originalism of the Constitution and developing what they are now full-blown, you know, and the whole Supreme Court practically is populated by them. But they were just beginning, you know, in opposition to the Brown versus Board of Education decision, impeach Earl Warren. So in that, you know, and in that mix of, you know, liberalism as a kind of ascendancy in the 1960s with John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson and then, you know, Carter for a little bit. It started, you know, reversing itself with Reaganism. But the multiculturalism, you know, we as liberals and radicals, as Todd Gitlin, he says, we won the halls of Ivy, you know, we won the curriculum, but they won the politics, and we kind of won the cultural war. But then that started getting reversed in the 1990s with this right-wing attack on standards, you know, teaching history, which was a huge battle. I didn't at that time know the origins of the Nation of Immigrants, but it was being argued by liberals as absolutely essential for the kind of healthy nationalism of the United States going toward the 21st century of having to hold on to. It was deeply embedded in the whole multicultural idea, you know, an ideology that these fights are still going on. But in some ways, the Nation of Immigrants is a settled matter. I did notice that that Trump took it out of the page on immigration, you know, the official State Department page on U.S. immigration policies. It was very flowery what got put in there, you know, and over time it changed a bit, but it's been called a Nation of Immigrants on that page up until Trump took it out. And then it was one of the first acts, I think, of the Biden administration was to put it back in. You know, I was tracking it in real time. I was checking almost every day. When are they going to revise this page? You know, and it's almost like the day after inauguration, that page got put back in. So it's still a very live, important. And I think its importance is that it does camouflage. It's the most effective camouflage to the reality of settler colonialism and genocide. And, you know, that's linked with the not dealing with what I dealt with in an Indigenous People's History of the United States. That actually I wanted to call that book simply The History of the United States. Because there is no history of the United States without how the land was taken, how the continent was taken. That is U.S. history, and it is left out. So the combination of elevating Nation of Immigrants and then almost totally obliterating, when there is anything in school textbooks about Native Americans, it's almost all cultural. You know, it... You know, it'll tell about Alcatraz and it'll tell about Wounded Knee and even praise it, you know, and everything, but not really talk about the land and sovereignty and the land that was taken and the huge elimination, intentional elimination. So it's only been, you know, since the 1960s that scholars have dealt with settler colonialism as a theoretical, and it's really developed with a generation of Native scholars in the last 20 years, especially in the last five, actually even since my book was published in 2014. There's so much I could have, enriched that book with literature that's come out since 2014. It's just amazing. There's a whole journal that started called Settler Colonial Studies. Article after article, just brilliant archive of literature. So, but it's still very marginal in the society and, you know, in the intellectual world in general, not to speak of the general society or the politicians.
Speaking of Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, radical historian, author of many books, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States, her latest is Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Exclusion. So I guess the question I want to get at is kind of, when America promotes itself as a nation of immigrants, there is some national project that it's in trying to incorporate those arrivants, as you might call them, into. You argued that that national project is still settler colonialism. What does it mean to be a newcomer incorporated into a settler colonial project?
Yeah, that's really fraught because, of course, most people who've immigrated to the United States have no knowledge of U.S. history beyond the propaganda that about the mythology about the United States. You know, the great first democratic revolution, brilliant founders who wrote a constitution that still exists today and is almost perfect. And, you know, if they care at all, I mean, many are refugees and they just, you know, they just want out of where they are and they want to go somewhere where they can get a job. And as of the 1870s, the United States was the major industrial powerhouse in the world, you know. So of course this was a destination for anyone, you know, impoverished, and it was for jobs, you know. They came for jobs and they were recruited for jobs, so they weren't coming with, I think, any flowery image, you know. It was just where they could support their families and often send remittances back to people who couldn't come. Most people in the world hadn't had the direct experience with the United States that would make them not see this ideal. So they come without this knowledge, and then they have to jump through loops. And one thing I do in the book that I don't think it's been done before. I mean, I got bits and pieces from other works, but the processing of these people to make them Americans, it's most obvious in the writings and speeches of Theodore Roosevelt before, during, and after he was president. He was a racist of, you know, very high origins in New York, you know, very wealthy Roosevelt family, the original Dutch settlers' descendants. And he saw only Anglo-Saxons and Germanic people, Scandinavians, as actually human. Even just actually human. Others were subhuman, and he was, of course, a great promoter of the eugenics. You know, one of the first outspoken proponents of eugenics. And he had his own categories. So he didn't consider Eastern Europeans totally human, but he saw there they were. They came in droves. They came in the millions in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and into, you know, before immigration law stopped it in 1923, barred, you know, anyone that wasn't Western European or Scandinavian. But there they were, you know, all around. So he began, what he did was introduce Columbus as a founder of the United States, first founder, and kind of presented that to the Italians as something to identify with, you know, and the Catholic Church was very involved in this as well. It was a mechanism for Americanizing Italians to see themselves as American by collapsing Columbus being Italian and Catholic. And it worked. It worked. So it explains, you know, the statuary was all put up. All the Columbus statuary was put up by the Knights of Columbus and the Catholic Church all over the country. Plaques everywhere. And so this creation of this origin story of immigration, they're not really immigrants. They're simply descendants of Columbus and the Catholic Church who are returning, you know, returning to this destination. So then they fall into how they can be the best American possible, you know, rah-rah for the wars, rah-rah for the most extreme forms of nationalism. And basically, you know, many, many ending up on in very right-wing politics. So that, you know, that Americanization was one of the most interesting things to me, a learning experience, you know, just putting it together, that how literally, and then, you know, the Irish, how the Irish became white when they were so reviled when they arrived, you know, Irish refugees, they really were not considered white. You know, whiteness hadn't yet taken on the kind of, as we know it now, you know, of colonized people like the Irish just simply were put in that category, even though most were blue-eyed blondes. It didn't make any difference. They were inferior for being colonized, but they had the great advantage of being white as whiteness became more and more important with, you know, with the Civil War, with the failure of Reconstruction and Jim Crow. The color line, you know, became very, very distinct. Now, the thing that separates settler colonialism is a very clear line until the Irish came in great droves, you know, as refugees in the 1840s. Everyone before that came as a settler. And there were Irish, you know, there were Irish who came in the early 1700s, Irish Catholics who came, mostly better off people. There were Jews, there were Italians, there weren't many of any of these, but they came as settlers, and many of them became plantation owners, slave owners. They fell into the settler position, and there were no immigration laws. People just showed up. You know, there were no restrictions, except that no person could be a citizen of the United States unless they were a white male. And that's it. That was in the Constitution. So that was, you know, the first 100 years or 80 years, 80, 90 years of the United States. That was a definition of citizenship.
You mentioned it a short time ago that you had gotten thousands of Facebook comments in response to a question of how you should read up on the incorporation of Irish immigrants into American whiteness. How did you arrive at an answer to the question of when did the Irish become white in America?
I think the person who posted when they became police is absolutely accurate. It just was a juxtaposition of and timing. They came in the 1840s and 50s, and the first police forces were forming In fact, in the cities, you know, Philadelphia and New York and Boston, in particular, were Irish settlers to control the Irish. That was the main reason they were setting up police forces. There were gangs. You've probably seen the gangs of New York, which pretty accurately portrays the Anglo-Saxons beating up on the Irish and gangs fighting each other. It is very interesting because in the formation of these police forces, before that, there were no police. There were constables, you know. Of course, there were slave patrols. Those were specifically, you know, citizens' patrols to control slaves. And the militias for killing Indians, you know, Indian militias. But other than that, there were no police as we know police now. They began forming to control the seemingly out of control Irish gangs, like, you know, most poor immigrants. At first, they form societies, they form ways for self-protection, mutual protection, and mutual aid. And sometimes these become armed gangs and, you know, dangerous. But they were extremely active, you know, through the 1820s. I mean, the 1920s. But they, I think it was first in, maybe in Boston, that a non-gang Irish Catholic who came as, you know, with the refugees, actually got on the police force. But how it worked was the Irish were their societies formed in clans, you know, related but also unrelated, you know, clans, very much like Native people. So they had certain responsibilities and duties beyond the immediate family or even the extended family. It was extended, extended, extended. And a lot of it also went by counties, you know, the county they were from. So one would get this job, and then all of his extended relatives, clan relatives, or from his county who were refugees, he would bring them on, you know, have them apply until they became the majority of police at a certain point. Irish from the Irish refugees. And then, of course, other Irish started coming and immigrating as well, you know, not as starving refugees, but as colonized people, as oppressed, and also because they had relatives already here. So that's very interesting, you know, how that happened. They no longer make up the majority, actual majority of the police, because it's been a lot of, you know, work for diversity in police, and the Irish are considered white now, of course. But they had these Emerald Societies and police unions, and there's a thread that ties them together all over the country. And one way to become white, as James Baldwin wrote so extensively and accurately about, is to become racist against Black people. You know, expressing racism is one way immigrants could differentiate themselves from, you know, any kind of identity. Even if they were very poor, they weren't Black. You know, they weren't descended from slaves. So this is, you know, has a lot to do with our current police problem still today.
So the kind of an initial problem that the statement "where a nation of immigrants" creates is like all the caveats you have to throw out. Well, we're a nation of immigrants except the Native Americans who are already here, except the descendants of people who were brought here in chains as chattel slaves, except the people who came here not as immigrants, but as conquerors or settlers who were forcing Native Americans off their land. And the question that leaves you with is kind of, well, when does that project stop? Is there some magical delineating point in American history where we can say new arrivals are not part of a settler colonial project anymore?
Well, that's the problem. And I really try to I grapple with that in the last chapter, in the conclusion, actually. Because since 1963, the opening of immigration from Africa and Asia and Latin America and the Pacific, you know, opening it up to not just Europeans, we have a very diverse immigration. It got more and more diverse and more people. There is the issue of immigrants becoming settlers, because once they're the next generation comes along, they're no longer immigrants. They have the stories of that, and then when the next generation, they're pretty much Americanized. You know, they know nothing that that's their country. They would, if they were deported to their home country, they wouldn't feel comfortable at all. So we have the problem of even people of color immigrants who don't know this history. They don't know it any better than anyone else. How could people know U.S. history when all they've listened to is Voice of America, you know, or read the regular U.S. media? I suppose with the internet, people can, if they want to, find more, but usually people who want to immigrate don't want to know the bad things. You know, they want to keep their idea of the United States intact. So there's a certain avoidance, but they come and there's no visibility for most immigrants who arrive of Native people. You know, there aren't that many immigrants going to, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, or Albuquerque, or South Dakota. I mean, there are some, you know, and those who go, they do see the presence of Native people, you know, land and reservations and all. And often the Native people can, you know, educate them or educate their children. But in general, Native people don't have an opportunity to educate immigrants who come and settle in cities. And I found that, you know, the immigration sites where people go for jobs is so broad now. It's not just the big cities, but, you know, places in Georgia and West Virginia and Appalachia where, you know, there are jobs and processing plants, you know, in North Carolina and these places that were not big sites for immigration. People went to mainly wherever the job, you know, wherever there are jobs. There are, I found, some very conscious immigrants who've written books. They know about the Native people being there, the presence, and they work in solidarity with Native rights. And there are, you know, things that have happened, like the Standing Rock standoff and the pipeline events that do provide information, you know, but if an immigrant gets interested and reads more, and, you know, there's quite a lot of Native American literature available now where they could learn. And I know my book, Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States, is one of the things I had in mind when I wrote it, was that it would get in the hands of new immigrants who would, you know, I just thought there was no single volume I could think of that would give a, you know, a literary and not, you know, boring history and text that could inform people. And traveling around and doing lectures, I found that, you know, really a desire on the part of third world immigrants to learn more and to be in solidarity and contribute, you know, and not to just fall into this sort of Americanism, having to be super, but they're very self-confident people, you know, and mostly scholars and all, but many immigrants are in, you know, they don't become citizens immediately. They still have to go through that processing. They have to memorize, you know, a test, and that test is pure, you know, rah-rah Americanism. And they have to jump through loops. And I think many probably simply don't want to know, because if they knew, then they would have, you know, they might have problems if they were to speak out. So that, you know, that's the difficult thing when the government itself and even liberal establishments and the whole educational system hides that history of the United States, you know, the genocide and settler colonialism and the conquest. It's something that is too dangerous to know, you know, for their own good. I found it interesting, some interviews I found with African immigrants who, and so also Somali refugees, that they were often resettled in African American neighborhoods. And they didn't, you know, they're in Africa, everyone's black, so blackness is not strange to them, you know, that's normality. But they come as an immigrant here, and they're seen as, you know, descendants of enslaved Africans in the United States. They suffer the same kind of racism, the same kind of even, you know, violence and police violence. These are very self-conscious people who've written these things of how they look down on black people in the United States. They actually felt superior. And that wasn't because they had gone through a process of becoming white, but because they were very confidently black, you know. So that was very interesting. But there's also, you know, like Obama is an instance. He's not descendant from slavery in the United States. He was a son of a Kenyan immigrant, or a Kenyan student who had a student visa to Hawaii. So basically, he was, you know, he was not in, and he was raised by his mother, of course, as his grandparents who were white and from Kansas, settlers, you know, really settlers. So I detected when I was writing the book, you know, Indigenous People's History, during his presidency, and I was really paying attention to his behavior, and it's very much settler. Very much, and his words as well, which I quote, you know, in this book, was very much a settler mentality, very natural settler mentality. And of course, his wife is, you know, different. I mean, she's descendant of enslaved Africans in the United States. And the settler, the immigrant can become a settler. You know, it's a default, actually, unless they resist it. And if they resist it, they miss out, you know, on some of the prizes of Americanism.
That's probably a good insight to end on. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, thank you so much for the book. Thank you for spending time speaking to us about it.
Thank you, Brian.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is a radical historian, author of many, many books, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Her latest is Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Exclusion.